Welcome to the Life Sciences Revolution podcast. I'm your host, Alex Wise, and today we're going to be taking a dive into the world of organ transplant surgery and research with Dr. Robert Montgomery. Dr. Montgomery is the chairman and professor of surgery at NYU Langone Health and is the director of the NYU Langone Transplant Institute, one of the U.S.'s leading transplant centers. He received his MD from the University of Rochester School of Medicine, his Doctor of Philosophy in Molecular Immunology from the University of Oxford, and completed his General Surgical Training, Multi-Organ Transplantation Fellowship, and Postdoctoral Fellowship in Human Molecular Genetics at Johns Hopkins. Dr. Montgomery has been at the forefront of the organ transplantation field for decades. He was part of the teams that developed the laparoscopic procedure for live kidney donation, conceived the idea of domino-paired donations, created the Hopkins Protocol for desensitization, and more recently, completed the first successful investigational kidney and heart xenotransplantations. On top of all of this, Dr. Montgomery has a very personal connection with the field, having received a heart transplant himself at the Transplant Institute that he founded and by the surgeons that he hired. He's a world expert and top opinion leader on everything transplant related, and it was a pleasure getting to hear his thoughts on the current status of the field and the research prospects of the future. So now, without further ado, here is my conversation with Dr. Robert Montgomery. So before we get into any of those exciting developments in organ transplantation, I want to start off with the story of your life as a surgeon and a patient in the same field. So can you tell us the story of your life, fascinating, unique, and depending how you look on it, slightly ironic roller coaster story of your heart and life as a transplant surgeon?
Sure. So, you know, I would say that my identity as both a surgeon and a patient evolved simultaneously over the past 30 some years. I was an intern at Johns Hopkins when I got a phone call in the middle of the night. I was actually on call in the hospital from my sister-in-law telling me that my brother, who was then 35 years old, had dropped dead while water skiing and they hadn't been able to revive him. Of course, you know, at that moment, I connected a lot of dots that had not been connected until then. My father had died in his early 50s from a disease called cardiomyopathy, which is a disease of the heart muscle. So it's different than, you know, what we traditionally think of as heart disease, which involves the blood vessels that supply the heart that get blocked and then you have a heart attack. This is a deterioration of the muscle itself and the conducting system, the part of the heart that is responsible for the electrical heartbeat that you pick up with an EKG. And it causes an accumulation of injury over time, which then can lead to a sudden death or having a dysrhythmia that in most cases people don't recover from. So, you know, I had one of my professors actually, who was a cardiac pathologist, look at my brother's heart and he made the diagnosis. And it was pretty clear at that point that this was a genetic disorder that was in our family. So I immediately got evaluated. And when I was on a treadmill, I developed a very bad dysrhythmia that is a rhythm disturbance that can lead to a sudden death. At that time, this was in the 1980s, at Hopkins, the implantable defibrillator, or the ICD, had just recently been invented by one of the surgeons and a physician at Hopkins. And so they told me that I was going to need one of these, that was the only way to protect me from my brother's fate, and that I needed it right away, and that it would probably end my career as a doctor, but almost certainly I wouldn't be able to be a surgeon, that it just wasn't compatible with being a surgeon. So you can imagine, you know, I had already invested a lot of time and this intense desire that I had had to become a surgeon. And it was a absolute stunning turnaround in the wrong direction for, you know, what I thought was going to be my life trajectory. But obviously, you know, I didn't really have a choice. And so I had the defibrillator placed. Fortunately, I had a great mentor at the time, who was my chairman. And he said, look, You had planned to go into the laboratory to get some research training. Go ahead and do that. Let's see how things go. We can reassess when you're finished with your research training. So I went off to Oxford, where I had, you know, set up a two-year research program, which I extended then. And I went ahead and got a PhD. I think part of that was that, you know, I really liked research and I was enjoying what I was doing and I was doing well. But I also knew in the back of my mind that, you know, this could be another pathway. If I wasn't able to return and finish my surgical training, I could become a scientist. So when I did come back and I was still doing well and basically took all the equipment that, because one of the big concerns was whether the electrical equipment that we used in the operating room, and principally the electrocautery, which is the device that we use to make incisions that cauterizes the blood vessels as you cut through the tissue so you don't get bleeding, that they thought would trigger my defibrillator and make it go off. Because we knew that if you use the electrocautery on a patient who had a defibrillator, it would trigger it. And so they always had to be turned off before the surgery. Again, this was at the very beginning of ICDs. I was the first surgeon in the world to get a defibrillator placed. And so they didn't really know. But I went into the electrophysiology lab with all these instruments and we tested them all and it was okay. So that was one of the major hurdles. And, you know, it was a big deal back then to have an ICD placed. It wasn't this little thing that's the size of, you know, a silver dollar up in your shoulder. I had to have a device placed in my abdomen that was like the size of a Coke can and had to have my chest open and patches put around the heart. So this was one of the original, you know, early prototypes of this device. I was able to finish my training and then, you know, the next sort of 20 some years were marked by relative stability most of the time, punctuated by, you know, near-death experiences. So I had a total of 7 cardiac arrests where I went into one of these rhythms, basically fell over dead, and either the device shocked my heart back, or in one or two cases, the device wasn't able to convert my heart, and I had prolonged CPR and external defibrillation and was able to come back. I was very lucky. Any one of those episodes, you know, potentially could have been terminal. So in 2017, I was down in Patagonia where I'm an outdoorsman. I love it down there. And I was in a very remote area and I went down there with a pneumonia likely. And it happened to be a multi-drug resistant pneumonia that probably picked up in the hospital, got really sick with septic shock. It made my heart arrest and I was in a coma for a month and then eventually got airlifted out back to NYU and, you know, shook that off. But that was a real low point because when I woke up, I couldn't walk or talk or eat or do anything. I was like a newborn baby, basically. And that recovery was the hardest thing I've ever done. It much more difficult than the recovery after my heart transplant, which happened about a year later. And again, that was triggered by what's called a ventricular tachycardic storm, where my heart went into one of these rhythms and kept getting shocked. And then it would go back into the rhythm. And that qualified me, believe it or not, up till that point, I wasn't really sick enough to be listed for a transplant. There's so few transplants done each year, only 3,500 heart transplants. There aren't enough organs. There's 1 million people who have heart failure in the U.S. And, you know, that gauntlet is very tight. So the people who are eventually offered the best solution for heart failure are few. So I had to get that sick in order to be, you know, considered for a heart transplant. And then, you know, I told my surgeons, because we had just very recently started this protocol where we were able to use hearts from drug overdose victims who had hepatitis C. 25% of the drug overdose deaths that result in donation have hepatitis C. And traditionally, we only put those hearts into people, recipients who had hepatitis C. And there's very few of them, and a lot with the opioid epidemic of overdose victims who have hepatitis C. So we are actually unable to use and discarding 50% of those organs. And, you know, at a time that we have this tragic shortage of organs, we were unable to use such a large number of perfectly good organs. And so we had started with these new drugs, the direct acting antivirals that cure hepatitis C. We were giving the recipients the hepatitis C pills right after they got their transplant, and that was curing them. So if you take a hepatitis C positive organ and put it into a hepatitis C negative recipient, it's nearly 100% likelihood that you'll get hepatitis C. And I got hepatitis C. It showed up within a few days after my transplant. And then I took the drugs for 2 months and it cured it. So I was the 17th subject in a trial that I had started that we brought from Hopkins, that where the first one of these studies was done, because I had just come from Hopkins to NYU at that point. And the NYU surgeons that I had hired to start our heart program did my heart transplant. And now I'm 4 years out and doing great. I've never felt better. I'm able to do everything.
It's an amazing story. And it's actually, it's just a wild series of events and just the level of ingrainment that you as a surgeon, your career, being involved with the Hep C positive clinical trials or with the early stages with the pacemaker and then putting together the team that is then operating on you. And I can't imagine what it was like to have that blow in your early career with focusing on being a surgeon and then all of a sudden coming to a stop only for that restart again. And it's amazing how someone can go through such high level trauma and physical stress and then bounce back over and over again. And I think it's just a testament to your mental fortitude and your team's skill set at the Transplant Institute. So an inspiration. Thank you very much for being open to sharing that story. So now that we know how involved you are, I don't think there's anyone else who can be more involved.
I've got skin in the game. Yeah.
Skin, heart, you have organs in the game. Let's get more into the state of organ transplantation and the biggest issues in the field today. So to me, when I think of organ transplantation, there are kind of two sides to the coin when I think of it. I think of the surgery itself and then the organs for the surgery. When it comes to the potential choke points, my mind immediately jumps to quantity, and I think most people's minds jump there as well. And so as it stands, there's considerably more demand and need for high-quality organs than there is supply. And there are about 100,000 people on the national organ transplant waiting list, and 90% of them are waiting for kidney transplants. So let's say patient A comes in, needs a kidney transplant. What's the process that they go through and their surgeons go through for finding them a suitable match? And how do different donor pools, whether it's live or deceased, play a role in this process?
Yeah, so you immediately, I think, you know, excuse the pun, but you went to the heart of it. The biggest problem, the biggest unmet need we have is organ availability. And that's why we have a wait list, right? That's why people have to wait. They have to wait for someone else to die. So when you think about it, our entire paradigm for supplying organs, life-saving organs, is based on someone having to die so somebody else lives. That's a problem in general. And they have to die in a certain way. And less than 1% of the people who die each year die in a way where they could actually donate organs. So it's really a numbers game. And on top of that, when you look at what comes out of the other end, only a third of the people who are listed for a transplant ever make it across the finish line. The other two thirds either get too sick and get delisted or they die. We've got something that works and works well, but we can't deliver enough of that something to the people who need it. It's a pretty unique situation when you think about healthcare and about, you know, really any kind of supply chain. We've become a little more conscious of broken supply chains in the last few years, but, you know, that's a new thing too for us all. And this is perhaps the one that is most serious, because if you can't get an organ in time, there's really no good alternative. So in terms of the, you know, 90,000 or so people waiting for a kidney transplant, yeah, there's an advantage to kidney transplantation because of two things. One, there's a possibility of a living donor, right? So for a heart, there's not a possibility of a living donor. Number two, there is a reasonable alternative that can keep somebody alive, which is dialysis, right? Now, dialysis can keep people alive, but if you end up staying on dialysis, you only live half as long on average than somebody who gets a transplant. So your longevity is very significantly reduced by 50%. And on top of that, the quality of life is not very good on dialysis. And then, you know, the trifecta of kidney transplantation is that dialysis is really expensive and a lot more expensive than a transplant. So you could live longer, live better, and have less of a drain on the healthcare system by getting a kidney transplant versus staying on dialysis. But truth is that most people have to wait somewhere between 3 and 6 years, depending on where they live, to get a kidney transplant. In New York, it's even longer. You know, people are waiting up to 10 years for a kidney transplant. Now, if you're lucky, if you're one of the 5,000 people each year that is really lucky and has a suitable living donor, and that person is willing to give them one of their kidneys, because we only need one kidney, then you sort of hit the jackpot and you get a better quality kidney because, you know, it's from somebody who hasn't been through some terrible tragedy that has resulted in their death. And the amount of time that the organ's outside of the body is usually pretty short. There's not all the instability that you see when someone dies. And those organs from living donors, as a result, tend to last about twice as long. So a kidney from a deceased donor has a half-life. So a time when half the kidneys have failed and half are still working is about 8 to 10 years. For a living donor, it's like 18 to 20 years. So if you're lucky enough to get a living donor, you're able to get a higher quality kidney that's likely to last longer. But, you know, somebody else has to undergo an operation that they don't need for you. And thank goodness there are wonderful people out there willing to do that. Even some people who don't even know the recipient. So each year there are somewhere between 250 and 300 people who are what we call, you know, non-directed donors or altruistic donors who just say, you know, I want to give my kidney to anyone who needs it. And that's a powerful thing too, because that can set off one of those domino transplants that you mentioned earlier and allow people who wouldn't have otherwise been able to get a living donor because of an incompatibility with their donor to receive a transplant. And we do about 1,000 transplants from domino transplants a year. The process that you have to go through, first of all, if we had an unlimited number of organs, we have 800,000 people who have end-stage kidney disease. Only 90,000 of them are on the list. So think about that. That's a huge drop off. So why are those people on the list? Well, because we think that they're most likely to benefit from a scarce resource, right? If we had unlimited organs, there would be a lot more than 90,000 people listed. But we, in the end, have to choose people who are most likely to benefit. So you have to go through a very intensive workup to try to minimize the likelihood that you'll have a problem in the operating room or after the transplant. You have to have some basic, you know, support structure in place because it's a big deal to get a transplant and you can't do it on your own. You've got to have people to help you. The drugs are, you know, that you have to take afterward are very complicated and you need somebody to be a caretaker as well. So there's an evaluation process for the recipient. And then we look at all of those things. We look at, is this someone who's likely to benefit from a transplant versus the other options? Then they're listed. And again, if they have someone, they're fortunate enough to have someone who's willing to give them a kidney, and that person won't be harmed by giving a kidney, so they have to be in really tip-top shape, then they undergo a planned, scheduled living donor transplant. You can get that before you're on dialysis. So that's called a preemptive transplant. So at a time point when you're not quite ready to go on dialysis, but we know that dialysis is going to happen soon, you can actually get your transplant, never have to get dialysis, and you do better after the transplant under those circumstances. You have a better life expectancy. Everything's better. You don't have to go through the risk of, you know, transitioning onto dialysis.
And you mentioned at the beginning, it's almost like a bizarre paradox for death turned into life. And so let's quickly go back to this wait list really quick. You know, I've always wondered how it works, and I appreciate you shedding some light on that. But I'm curious how this process has changed over time from when you first started practicing versus now, because to me, this always seems like it's a data analysis problem that you need to tackle algorithmically. And so my understanding is right now it is a computational problem, but that algorithm is a little bit of a black box to me in the sense, you know, I get there's like a negative screen at the beginning. If the blood types are not compatible, you're not going to be going through. And then there are other factors, probably height, weight, et cetera, et cetera. Can you elaborate on how it's changed over time from when you first started?
Yeah. So the algorithm for a living donor is a bit different than somebody who doesn't have a living donor and their only option is a deceased donor. But in terms of the evolution of those, both of those types of kidney transplants over the years, I mean, first of all, we have a lot more people who are in need. So kidney disease is on the rise, end stage kidney disease. And that's probably because we're a bit more unhealthy as species and as a country these days. Things like obesity, high blood pressure are the leading causes of kidney disease. Diabetes is on the rise, and that's, you know, one of the top three. So as a result, there are a lot more people who need them. And there's been some growth in the number of donors, but it hasn't been able to keep pace at all. The growth in the need is exponential. The growth in the supply has been incremental and is not that impressive. Sadly, in recent years, a lot of that growth has come from the opioid epidemic and the drug overdoses. Last year, there were 107,000 people in the U.S. who died of a drug overdose. If you can imagine, that's three or four times the number who died, you know, traumatic deaths, motor vehicle accidents and things like that. It is just absolutely staggering when you think about the number of victims of the opioid epidemic. And, you know, it, you know, continues to really limit really the ability of us to get people that need a transplant transplanted quickly. And for deceased donor organs, what the trend that we've seen during my career is that the organs tend to be from older individuals, tend to be a bit more distressed, and all of the same diseases, you know, high blood pressure, diabetes, and hypertension that result in kidney disease also result in premature death. So more and more of our potential deceased donors have those diseases.
Is that why you mentioned that the living versus dead rates for how long the kidney transplant lasts is 10 years versus 20 years is because they're coming from those later stage individuals?
That's a big part of it. And for, you know, living donors, it's only safe to remove one kidney from somebody if they're in really top health. They can't have, you know, high blood pressure, heart. Well, in some cases, high blood pressure is acceptable from an older donor, but, you know, things like diabetes, heart disease, significant obesity can be showstoppers, usually are showstoppers for living donation. So yes, that's part of the explanation for why living donor kidneys do better, because they come from the healthiest people in our society. So living donation, you know, there's been a tremendous number of innovations, some of which, you know, I've been a part of. First of all, we developed at Hopkins the procedure for removing a donor kidney from a living donor laparoscopically or minimally invasive. So that meant that rather than a person being in the hospital for 7 days, now they're in the hospital for 2 days. They're back to work in 2 weeks rather than 6 to 8 weeks. The impact of kidney donation on the donor is much less than it used to be. So we've had that. And then we had the ability to do incompatible transplants where either by blood type or tissue, the donor and recipient are incompatible. So Alex, for you and I, you know, if you wanted to give your kidney to me, there would be a 35% chance that we would be blood type incompatible. So we lose a third of our potential donors right away. You know, again, we developed the ability to cross that incompatibility using various techniques, or to just avoid it by swapping kidneys. So our transplant center would find another pair that had the opposite incompatibilities, and we would just swap our kidneys between the two pairs. That concept then led to us developing the domino donation, where you have a chain of transplants that's kicked off by one of these non-directed donors or altruistic donor who gives to somebody who has an incompatible donor, and that donor gives to someone else who has an incompatible donor, and that donor gives, and it's like a daisy chain. And then at the end of that, there's a kidney that goes to the deceased donor list, and some lucky person at the top of the list gets a living donor kidney. And we do 1,000 of those a year now in the US. Despite all of those major innovations, we're still doing the same number of living donor transplants that we were doing 6 or 7 years ago. It hasn't grown. It's still 5,000. So that's very disappointing. I mean, that's been an extremely disappointing thing for me, you know, to really advance these new methods of getting more people transplanted. But at the same time, for whatever reason, the number of living donors has contracted. So we're on kind of a flat line with living donation. A pretty good slow increase with deceased donor organs, but remember, they're not quite as good. They don't last as long. And part of that is being driven by the opioid epidemic, which I believe that with the amount of money that is being invested in addiction research and therapy, upward of $50 billion last year, we're going to have the equivalent of an airbag for drug overdoses, right? I mean, the number of donors now coming from motor vehicle accidents has just been on this very steady decline because of the airbag, and a lot fewer people are dying and becoming brain dead from motor vehicle accidents, thank God. And I think something similar is going to happen with the opioid epidemic. So we're very vulnerable. We can't deliver what we need. And believe me, when I was waiting for a transplant, that became very evident to me, and I lived it and I experienced it in a very direct way. And that really changed my way of looking at where we are and where we need to get.
So it sounds like at the end of the day, you know, the problem comes down to the fact that we're relying upon an unreliable source. So let's talk about ideas for how to mitigate that issue. How do we switch from an unreliable source to a reliable source? And you know, it sounds like there's been some considerable progress with expanding the organ donor pool. And as you mentioned, I think you said desensitization there, hepatitis C positive donors, you know, all of these ideas to buff up the supply side of the organ transplant equation. There's a novel concept that I find particularly interesting, xenotransplantation, which is maybe a way to, you know, add an unlimited amount in theory to the supply side. And that's the process of using non-human animal sources to help close that gap between the patients who need an organ and the lack thereof. And so you performed the first successful investigational porcine kidney xenotransplant last year, I believe. And so this was pig to human, porcine meaning of the pig, where you used a genetically engineered pig to mitigate immune response. And I think we'll come back to the immune response idea as well. But can you come and tell us a little bit more about this concept, its current status of development, next clinical steps, and a bit about what it takes to make a safe and reliable source of pig organs?
Sure. You know, I just want to say, too, before we go on to that thank God for the wonderful people and the families of those people who have enabled, you know, our transplant system through donation, either living donation or deceased donation, because I wouldn't be here today without a family having made the decision to, you know, honor the desire of their loved one to donate their organs. And one of my other brothers, who's had a heart transplant now for 26 years, he wouldn't be here either. So I just want to make it really clear, although I gave a somewhat gloomy, you know, view of where we are now and where I think that's going, we still are so thankful for these altruistic, wonderful individuals who in the moment, the worst moment of their lives, are willing to literally open their hearts to individuals who are in a desperate situation and donate organs. It is one of the most heroic and incredible decisions that anyone can make, both, you know, in their lifetime and then when they pass through their families. So that's where we're starting from. But yes, if we had an unlimited supply of organs, a sustainable supply of organs, I think we could do a lot more good than we're able to do right now. First of all, almost anybody who gets listed for a transplant would be able to get a transplant very rapidly. Wouldn't have to wait, wouldn't have people dying waiting and getting too sick. And then I also believe that we could offer organ transplantation to a lot of those folks that never get listed, because we just know that with the scarce organs that we have, they're unlikely to get an organ and unlikely to benefit from getting an organ if they have to wait a long time. So the analogy that I use is that, you know, I think about like our current organ supply, living donors and deceased donors, as sort of the fossil fuel, you know, of organ supply. And, you know, we've made it better. We've made all these incremental improvements. We've increased it and so on, but it's never going to be sustainable. And xenotransplantation or transplanting pig organs into humans and bioartificial organs. So, you know, starting with a scaffolding, whether that's from an animal or from 3D printing, and then putting, you know, human cells on top of that scaffolding and coaxing them down different pathways of development. You know, these are the wind and the solar of the future. This could give us, either of these could give us an unlimited supply of organs and change the trajectory of this whole thing. And we wouldn't have to rely on the paradigm that somebody has to die for somebody else to live. So, you know, obviously I've given this a tremendous amount of thought through my transplant process and journey. I think that xenotransplantation, or, you know, using pig organs, is a bit closer at hand. And that's where I've thrown a lot of my intensity and energy into. But at the same time, we're also working with a company that's developing bioartificial organs. So yes, last year, September of 2021, we took a pig kidney that had been genetically modified. So it was more humanized, if you will, or less likely to be rejected immediately. And we put it into a human who actually was brain dead. So this was someone who had wanted to donate their organs, but their organs weren't suitable for donation. You know, under a protocol with a regulatory oversight, we approached the family and family consented to whole body donation. So rather than organ donation, the person who had died, who was still on a ventilator. So, you know, when you become brain dead, your heart will keep beating, but you stop breathing. You know, the brain regulates breathing, doesn't regulate heartbeat, but your heart will stop if there's no oxygen going to it. So you've got to be ventilated. So if you keep somebody on a ventilator, you can keep their heart going. And that's how we're able to place deceased donor organs from brain dead donors, basically, because we can do all that. But in this case, rather than donating their organs, they're donating their whole body for the purpose of a high stakes type of research study. In this case, to see if we can get a genetically modified pig organ to work in a human, because up until now, all of the research has been done in primates, so in monkeys, basically, who have received pig organs. But there's a lot of things that have worked in animals that when you put them in humans, they don't work. So this was really breakthrough procedure, and we were able to do it without putting a living human at risk, right? So this was an intermediate step between the primate work and the first living human trial, because we tested this on somebody who was already dead, who was being maintained on a ventilator for 3 days. So we could see if the organ worked during those 3 days, did what it was supposed to do and wasn't rejected. And we could do that without, because the person was already dead, their heart was still beating, but they were brain dead. That's our definition of death in our society. We were able to do that without the potential of causing harm to that individual because they were already dead, but do it in a way that we could really test to see if these things were going to work, these organs. So we've done four of those now, two kidneys and two hearts. the hearts that we used were more complex. They had 10 genetic edits. So both knockouts and also we put some human genes in those pigs in their genome that made it so that the human proteins could interact better with their target. You know, we introduced some of these key human genes that make a protein that in the form that the pig makes have some difficulty interacting with their partner, you know, on the human side. And those had to do with a couple of systems that are important for the immune response and also for blood clotting and inflammation. So the kidneys that we used for the first two of these transplants that we did were fairly simple genetic modifications, just one knockout. And the hearts we used were much more complicated, had 10 gene edits. And that was based on the primate work, because we've learned a lot from the primate work, but we're kind of at a point now where we've been doing that for like 30 years. And, you know, we need to get this into the clinic because of all the reasons that I mentioned earlier. And we needed to make this step. And again, it was a smaller step than just putting it in a living human, you know, putting that person at risk.
Yeah, absolutely. So from a clinical perspective, it sounds like you need to be moving towards potentially either just doing more of these investigational, or are you looking to do, you know, first in human, living human? And also with the hearts versus kidneys, I imagine that there's a lot more, you know, regulatory oversight or burdens potentially to go through and move forward with the heart side, no? And so where are each of those at in terms of a regulatory perspective? And where do you see each of those going?
I mean, the regulatory process is identical for the kidney and the heart. The heart, for whatever reason, has seemed to be a bit more, fragile, if you will. In the preclinical primate studies, it seems to have required more genetic modifications to make it work than the kidney. Kidney needs to, for sure, have this one gene knocked out, which is a gene that makes an enzyme that makes a carbohydrate, so a sugar molecule. And that sugar molecule was lost during evolution between pig and human. So pigs express that carbohydrate on their cells, on all their cells, and humans don't. So during the process of developing our immune systems, we have to respond to the fact that we have bacteria living in our gut, right? That could kill us if it passed through the colon into the blood. And it just so happens that the outer surface of those bacteria have the same molecule that the pigs have, the same carbohydrate. And so we developed a bunch of antibody that circulate in our blood and are constantly on surveillance looking for those bacteria. But unfortunately, that they cross-react with the pig cells. And that has always caused an immediate, what we call a hyperacute rejection. So if you took a unmodified pig kidney and you attached it to, you know, a human blood vessel, within minutes to hours, that kidney would turn black and just be rejected immediately. But by eliminating that carbohydrate, knocking it out of the genome of the pig becomes more like the human. We don't attack our own tissue. So now that target for our antibodies goes away. So that's what we did for that pig kidney, is to knock out that carbohydrate. And that, you know, allowed the kidney to not be rejected and to function normally.
Gotcha. So knock out alpha gal, right? Knock out that, no alpha gal on the on the cell, so no immune response, or less, rather. And that's a question that I have there.
Yeah, it's not a preformed immune response. So what happens is with this carbohydrate is that every human has circulating antibody, you know, against that carbohydrate. So, you know, that's just sitting there waiting. And as soon as it sees that pig kidney, it rejects it. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a second type of rejection, which is called the adaptive immune response. And that takes time. That involves what are called T cells or lymphocytes. Now, lymphocytes, you know, engage in this process of recognizing that, something is foreign, and then responding, and the whole machinery that's required for that response takes about 7 to 10 days to get revved up. So that's called the adaptive immune response. So with what we've done at this point, since we've only observed these decedents for 3 days, and after 3 days, then we've turned the ventilator off, which is what would happen, with someone who's brain dead. Once they're declared brain dead, the ventilator is either just turned off right away, or they donate their organs, or in this case, they donate their whole body. And then for 3 days, we do the study. And then the body is then released to the family and to, a mortician, and the funeral happens. So, we're now at a point where what we want to do is, instead of just observing the decedent with the pig organ for 3 days, we want to go for a month so that we can see this adaptive immune response, the second line immune response, to see whether by using, certain immunosuppressive drugs and the knockouts and knock-ins, that the genetic modifications, that we can prevent that type of rejection, which we do pretty well with a human organ, and so we want to be able to try to replicate that.
If we can avoid the hyperacute immune response with these knockouts, and then, as you said, you want to look and follow the pathway, or rather the timeline, for longer to watch the adaptive immune response, how close can you get it to be the same level of, in theory? Now, this is obviously theory with a human transplant. And I guess maybe preceding that, is there always some degree of an adaptive immune response, irrespective of donor, porcine, deceased, altruistic, living donor, HCV, positive? I guess, or how would you rank those in terms of the likelihood of an immune response, and what are the different factors that play in there?
Yeah, so I would put it at the top, like the biggest immune response you're going to get is with a pig organ, because the differences in the amino acid sequence, so the building blocks of proteins, are greater between a pig and a human than they are between two humans, right? Or any, two individuals of any species. They're more similar than we are to, the genome and the things that the genome encodes in a pig. And so those differences are what our immune system responds to. And so there's more differences if you have a pig organ, and you're probably going to need a little more immunosuppression. But, a couple of the important differences is that, the pig organ, you can make genetic modifications to make those differences, once we determine which ones are most important, no longer differences, right? You can change the genome. With the pig organs, since you have an unlimited supply, and you can use the organs when they're young and healthy and without a lot of time outside of the body, all these things are advantages in terms of the inflammation that you get, and which can kick off the immune response. So all those things would kind of mitigate a stronger immune response. But still, I put the pig at the top. And then, things like hepatitis C can cause inflammation, and again, can trigger the immune system. So maybe that's the next one down. We know that, like in hearts, that there's a little bit of a higher rejection rate during time when before, after the hepatitis C starts circulating in the blood and the drugs that we give eliminate it, there's a little higher rate of acute rejection. And then I would put the deceased donor organs, because of the fact that those organs been through a lot of trauma, which can create inflammation, and also they tend to be longer to transport them, to where the recipient is. All of those things causes more inflammation and probably more of an immune response. And then living donor organs are probably the least triggering for the immune system. So that's kind of the hierarchy. So, you will need more immunosuppression, the drugs that I take every day to prevent my immune system from responding, in a pathway that leads to rejection. There's probably always a little bit of response, even with those drugs. And that's probably why organs don't last forever that are transplanted. They don't last as long as our own organs, right? because there's always probably some smoldering inflammation and a little bit of rejection, but those drugs hold it at bay and prevent it from, you know, causing the organ to go into a dysfunction.
So is that then potentially where the idea with a bioartificial organ could come in as far as immune response? If you're taking stem cells or your own cells and creating an organ from scratch there, then you obviously won't have the immune response that would be associated. Yeah, so
if you're using your own stem cells to repopulate those organs and, you know, recapitulate the function of the organ, you don't, you know, unless you have an autoimmune disease, you don't respond to your own cells. Your immune system is programmed. It's educated not to respond to self. And so that's the grand slam, right? That's hitting it out of the park, which would be to create a designer organ for any individual and start creating that before they become desperate, you know, and have it ready at the right time, and then switch it out. And then instead of living 100 years, maybe we live 125, maybe 150. And it's sort of like a car that, you know, you have the option of replacing the transmission and some of the key parts that keep it going. And I think that's our future. That's where this is all headed.
If you had to put a timeline to the future with those two major topics we've been discussing, xenotransplantation and bioartificial, where do you see us going? When are we going to be seeing pig transplants, then followed, in theory, bioartificial? 5, 10, 20 years?
So I would say for pig organs, I think we're going to be doing the initial trials in living humans within a year and a half to 2 years. And then it'll take a few years to be sure that that's safe and works well. So we're out to about 5 years. And then I think between 5 and 10 years from now, we'll be scaling, incrementally increasing. More transplant centers will be involved in this work. And about 10 years from now, I see xenotransplantation really making a significant difference in organ availability. You know, we'll still have living donors, we'll still have deceased donors, still have human organs, but we'll be getting people transplanted who would benefit, you know, from getting a transplant right away with pig organs. Bioartificial organs, each of those, I think you can double. So 20 years from now, so, you know, in a lot of people's lifetime, we'll get to that place that I described where, you know, you can rock on with some brand new components, and we'll be switching out people's organs. That will be one less thing to limit our lifespan.
Like going out and getting a new pair of glasses or something like that, hopefully one day. Sooner than many may think. Exciting developments on that front. Let's switch gears back. In the beginning, I mentioned there's the surgery and then there's the organs. And so we've been focusing on the organs. Let's switch gears to the surgery itself briefly. And so we mentioned transplant surgery, not a new concept. First successful kidney back in 1954. So way past the half century mark there. And, you know, not to diminutize it, you know, it's the same concept. Take the kidney out, put it into the patient. And it's changed a fair amount in terms of how it's completed. You mentioned the current laparoscopic nephrectomy you developed. And there's this paradigm in surgery, switching to minimally invasive procedures. Right. And so that tends to involve more robotics and often less of a human component. So where do you see transplant surgery going in that sense? And obviously, it'll depend on the organ of interest that we're discussing. But let's say, for instance, with kidney transplants, how much of the surgery itself can be standardized and completed by a robot? And how much of the surgeon's skill set do you see getting augmented or replaced in the near or short near future?
Yeah, so, you know, remember the robots are being driven by surgeons, up at least up till this point. You know, we're at a console. We're not, you know, at the bedside, actually, you know, throwing stitches and tying knots, but we're at a console. It could even be in the next room, you know, doing the operation robotically. It's an extension of the surgeon's hands, basically. But it is revolutionary. I think transplant surgery, because, you know, it involves taking an organ out and putting a new organ in for the most part. Sometimes we do leave the old organs in, usually for the most part in kidney transplantation. But if you do a heart transplant or a lung transplant or a liver transplant, you're taking the organ out, you're putting a new organ back in place where the old organ was. And that, you know, just passing those organs in and out of the body required an incision, right? So if you're going to make a big incision to put a liver in, it's not as transformative as if you are taking out, you know, a gallbladder or, you know, a kidney, because the person has cancer of the kidney, and you can drop it in a bag and morselize it and then pull it through a very small hole. So I would say that the impact of robotics has been less in transplantation than a lot of other fields in surgery. We only do minimally invasive surgery if it makes sense, if there's a benefit to the patient, right? Now, more and more, though, we're finding that there is a place, and it started with the donor operation, because there you have a normal person who is giving their kidney to someone else or part of their liver for someone else's benefit, and you want to obviously really limit the impact, and you only need to make an incision big enough to pull the organ out, right? So we can do a lot of the surgery minimally invasively with robotics. So that's how we kind of went down that pathway in transplant. But now there's the option, particularly in people who are overweight, you know, where you have to make a bigger incision to like sew a kidney in robotically. We can do that. People do that. And that's something that we're developing. And, you know, there are parts of the donor operation for a liver that we can do robotically. In fact, some people are doing the whole thing robotically. So we're seeing more and more use of the robot in transplant surgery, and that's only going to increase over time. But there's going to be a certain limitation, because we still have to take the old organ out and put a new organ in, and you have to make an incision for that. So it's never going to be completely without an incision robotically, but that's the future of surgery for sure in general.
Sounds like certainly more on the augmentation side than the replacing side. I know some people, yeah, not usually surgeons, are, but some people are always afraid of robots are taking over, and it's going to be the loss of the job, and or rather, you know, changing the paradigm. Which I guess this sounds like it could certainly help in that facet, but much more on the augmentation side.
Very interesting. Yeah, we want to be able to do surgery that has the least amount of impact on the patient. I mean, that is what they'll recover from faster and get back to work, get back to their daily life. So we're pushing this as far as we can, you know, on every front. And up until now, again, the robots have required, you know, the human to drive them. That could change at some point, but that's probably a ways off.
Well, in that case, let's cap it off with something a little more personal again. And I see that it's unfortunately not there today, but I still have to ask. Whenever you Google an image for Dr. Robert Montgomery, you always see a photo with this amazing mustache. And I want to know, where did the inspiration from that mustache come from? So, and I know this is audio only, so I want everyone listening to go pull out their phone or computer and look at the cover photo. And if I'll put that photo, there's you standing right there with the mustache in full view. And I just want you to admire the novelty. And so, as you can see, as a mustache connoisseur myself, you know, each stash usually has a name. Yeah, and I've currently got the, I think it's called the petite handlebar. So I have aspirations to make it the full handlebar one day. But I want to know, what did you call your style? Did you call anything as just the Montgomery, the transplanter?
No, I mean, it was sort of an augmented Fu Manchu. I mean, it was, a very bushy Fu Manchu. So, you know, the mustache, I don't know. It's a funny thing. Like, it, believe it or not, like, it just happened. And it just happened over time, and I got out of its way. But I never intended, you know, when I stopped shaving that part of my face, to have the result that, you know, I eventually got. And sadly, like so many other things in life, my mustache was a victim of the pandemic. I could not get that thing to be covered up by a mask where I could get a seal around it. So when COVID hit New York in March of 2020, I had to go to my barber and I told him to just take it all the way off. I've been seeing him for about 25 years and he was sort of staggered, tried to talk me out of it and just said, you know, this is, I could be like removing your power, you know? And anyway, it ended up being just fine. I now have a beard, and that happened. I was just up in Alaska. As I said, I'm an outdoorsman, and I was in a very remote part of Alaska with one of my sons. And then I went to Ukraine to do surgery there. I've been there a couple of times now. So I had a period of almost 3 weeks without a razor. And then this happened, what you're looking at now, which is a beard, which is, you know, I have weird facial hair. It's all different colors and got some red and gray and all sorts of things. And I'm just trying to decide now which way to go. And so I'm happy to hear from your audience whether, you know, I should move back in the direction of my old mustache or stay more with conventional beard. I've always wanted to have like the Martin Van Buren look, you know. So I'm tempted to go with a Fu Manchu and the Martin Van Buren sideburns, you know, mutton chops.
I think that's a great idea. I mean, I can imagine your barber shed a tear when you had to cut that. But I was thinking to myself, there's no way you could get an N95 on that. I mean, I can barely do it on one of these. But maybe we'll put a poll up or something if you're willing to start shaping it up again. Because I mean, the beard's great, don't get me wrong. But the stash was something that should be in a museum over there. But it's like a block of marble that's yet to be shaped, in my opinion. So we have to give you the inspiration. But thank you for answering that one. I was thinking, you know, what questions I really want to ask in this podcast, and that was probably number one. Anyways, Dr. Montgomery, thank you so much for taking the time to chat today and tell us about the field of organ transplantation, past, present, future, and the past and present and future of your mustache. Thank you very much. It was truly a pleasure.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Life Sciences Revolution podcast. If you did, please let us know with a review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Hope to see you back in the future with our next episode. But until then, here's Cenk Setup's In Motion to close us out.